Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Donald Trump made big promises to coal country on the campaign trail.
I'm thinking about the miners all over this country. We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to get those mines open. Coal country, what they've done.
Coal miner Jonathan Griffith takes Trump at his word. Here's how he describes the atmosphere at his mine the day after the election.
The next day, everybody was excited to go because they knew something better was going to happen, you know.
But not everyone is convinced Trump can deliver on his promises. And even some people who voted for Trump have their reservations.
He has not said things like I would ever say, and some of his opinions I completely disagree with.
We speak with Trump supporters, opponents, and people in between about how a Trump presidency will impact our region on this week's Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Appalachia voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. He won 95% of the counties here, and Trump did better in Appalachia than previous Republican candidates. But that doesn't mean everyone here is happy with the results. On today's show, we're going to hear from different people in our region. They'll talk about their hopes and fears surrounding Trump. We'll also take a closer look at what a Trump presidency means for Appalachia. But first, we check in on a project called 100 Days in Appalachia. We first heard about this project when it launched right after the inauguration of President Donald Trump. It's a collaboration among the West Virginia University Reed College of Media Innovation Center, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and the Daily Yonder. Journalist and the author of Dreamland, Sam Quinones, was recently featured on the website. Here's Sam talking about the opioid crisis in parts of Central Appalachia.
Really was the canary in our societal coal mine that was very much ignored by the rest of the country for years as that problem was festering.
Sam spoke with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Dave Mistich. Dave is an editor and contributor of 100 Days in Appalachia. Here's another excerpt from that interview.
Just after the election, you made a blog post on your website about the relationship of communities that were stricken by the opioid crisis and support for Donald Trump. What can you tell me about that relationship between these two communities, the opioid ravaged areas and the Trump nation, so to speak?
I think in states that were crucial to his victory, that connection is very, very strong. You know, he won Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Michigan. There was a few other states that he won that probably were essential, but were the pivotal states were the ones that I mentioned. And in those areas, what you found was something interesting. You found in a lot of those areas, unemployment rates were falling. They were at the lowest rates they'd been in, say, 6 or 8 or 10 years. You would think there would be some optimism generated by that. But hidden beneath those numbers is really a more somber reality. And the somber reality you run into if you go to those counties, which is where people say, if we have jobs open up, our employers tell us that 70% of our job applicants cannot pass a drug screen because they're hooked, they're in drug. Also, a lot of people are simply not in that unemployment count because they are strung out. I would say that there's a very strong argument to be made that in the last 2 years, 3 years, let's say, people have become far, far more aware of this problem in their communities.
That was Sam Quinones talking with Dave Mistich for the 100 Days in Appalachia project. Dave Mistich sat down with me recently to share more about how the project is going now that we're about halfway through the first 100 days of the Trump administration.
I think we're bringing in a wide swath of stories covering everything from during the first weekend of the inauguration, some women's marches that were going on in Pittsburgh. We're also hearing from people in the region down in Tennessee that heavily supported Donald Trump. This past weekend, during the March for Trump rallies that were going on around the country, there were a lot of folks out in Tennessee marching in support of the president. To read those stories, to get more into it, I think we're learning a lot, at least I am, and I think the audience is too, about different parts of the world in Appalachia and different worlds inside of Appalachia and how they're different than what, you know, the wider world might perceive it to be.
One thing we learned from the last presidential election is just how important social media and other digital platforms are when it comes to public opinion. In general, the public a lot of times doesn't necessarily know the difference between an opinion piece, an op-ed piece, and for that matter, dare I say it, the difference between biased news and fake news. How has this project addressed this issue?
Well, one of the things that we've done, or at least tried to do, is label any sort of op-ed or any sort of column as such. You know, whenever we post that material to social media, Facebook, Twitter, we also try to go out of our way to make sure that it's evident there, too. Op-eds can have facts in them as well, too. That platform, of course, is trying to reinforce a particular opinion or a particular perspective, which there's nothing wrong with that. We're just trying to go out of our way to make sure that those opinions, even if they are based in fact, are labeled as such.
How do you bring balance to that type of presentation on your website? Has it been challenging?
You know, I think it has been. I mean, I think if you look at national media, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other major news outlets, they've been very critical of Donald Trump. I think that, you know, obviously in national media, there's been a lot of attention and a lot of criticism towards this administration. But what I think, you know, others in media are doing as well right now is highlighting those that have supported the president and trying to understand their reasons why and hold this presidency and this administration accountable. You know, Trump country as the coal community or the coal community as Trump country narrative has certainly played out big time, you know, long before the election ever took place. But I think that there's a more diverse group of people that supported the president here in West Virginia and across Appalachia that we haven't heard from. And one of the things I'm working on personally is trying to find people that maybe aren't that stereotypical or that predicted sort of set of folks that's been, you know, laid out in other coverage thus far.
According to the website, one of the goals was to take a closer look at just what makes this region such a flashpoint for so many of the social, economic, and political fractures in American communities. Can you make any observations so far about what you're finding is the answer to this really complex question?
I mean, I think you just said it. It is a really complex question. I don't know that it can be accomplished in 100 days. I don't know that answering that question could happen in a year or 2 years, or maybe even a decade. But I think that it's worth looking at. I mean, you take a look at for example, the opioid crisis that's stricken Appalachia, particularly West Virginia, and now is playing out in the rest of the country. So if you really take a look at Appalachia and take a look at America as a whole, it doesn't take long to figure out why a lot of these issues that have bubbled up around the country have sort of manifested themselves either first or in ways that were able to be understood in a place like Appalachia.
Is there anything specifically that is coming out of the Trump administration that is just expected to impact or is impacting the region pretty significantly?
Well, I mean, one of the things that, you know, his big promise, especially to West Virginia, that it was going to bring coal jobs back. We've heard some reports in the region of that happening. You know, I think people are quick to point to him as the reason for that happening. Others are quick to say that he's not. You know, the stream protection rule rollback and other environmental regulations. I think that that's what we've seen most out of Appalachia. I think the Affordable Care Act is another issue that's affected Appalachians and particularly West Virginians. As most people realize, West Virginia is one of the states that takes advantage of the Affordable Care Act and various offers like Medicaid expansion more than a lot of other states in the country. You know, issues of healthcare and the economy as it relates to coal are certainly on people's radar. It remains to be seen what happens in the latter half of this first 100 days.
That was Dave Mistich with West Virginia Public Broadcasting talking about the 100 Days in Appalachia project. Dave is one of the editors and contributors to the project, and you can find more information about it on our website at wvpublic.org. As Dave mentioned, promises of more coal jobs played a large role in why West Virginia voted so heavily for Trump, and we'll talk more about that in this show. But it wasn't the only reason. Jessica Griffith says her Christian values played a large part of the reason why she and her mother voted for Trump.
You know, Trump stood for a lot of stuff that Christians stand for, you know, like with abortions and, or, you know, he's against abortions and stuff like that. And I think that plays a part in it. You know, when you're a Christian and you stand for God and you have somebody that has your beliefs, you know, you tend to lean towards that. You know, if you're against abortions, but you vote for somebody that's for abortions, you're kind of contradicting yourself.
But do you think that all of Trump's values are along the lines with Christian values?
Oh, I would say not. I mean, you're not going to find, like I said, nobody that's 100%, but, you know, you got to lean towards the one that's more guaranteed. Or, I mean, that's how I look at it.
Still, it wasn't the number one reason why she voted for Trump. And we're going to explore as we revisit a classic Inside Appalachia episode. Coal miner Jonathan Griffith describes what it was like inside the mine on election day.
It was such a big deal and a big day that, you know, they had to announce over the radio, you know, updates on who was winning, like what states was, you know, winning for who.
Jonathan's a roof bolter from Garwood, West Virginia, not too far from where I grew up. He says that on election night, as state after state was called for Trump, the excitement grew.
You could just tell by the more throughout the night, everybody just got a little bit more productive and light at the end of the tunnel, you know.
We're going to hear from Jonathan and his wife Jessica throughout the show. But first, we'll ask whether those miners have a reason to celebrate. Things are looking up for coal, at least a little bit. In the last few months, there's been a slight uptick in coal production caused by an increased demand for electricity and metallurgical coal, which is used to make steel. Even so, West Virginia mined only about 80 million tons last year, the lowest level in several decades. The reasons for the sharp declines in the coal industry have been described as a perfect storm of factors. Cheaper natural gas, change in markets, in addition to tighter environmental regulations. One economist said that the declining coal industry has created a situation comparable to that of the Great Depression in some places of West Virginia. At Donald Trump's spring campaign rally in West Virginia, the vice president of the West Virginia Coal Association, Chris Hamilton, gave Trump an award, a white hard hat that said, Friends of Coal. Trump put on the hat, and at the same rally, he said,
We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to put the miners back to work. We're going to get those mines open. Coal country.
This promise is the number one reason why coal miner Jonathan Griffith voted for Trump. I spoke with him and his wife at their home in Wyoming County, West Virginia.
Hopefully more jobs, you know. The man talked about wanting to get more jobs in everywhere, and this state right here could need it. We're basically, if you ain't coal mining or railroad, then you're either on welfare or you got a college education. And I'm hoping that he can bring in something to help everybody, and I believe he will.
So what makes you think that Trump will be able to create these jobs here in southern West Virginia?
He's a smart man, you know. He's a billionaire, millionaire, whatever, and he's just really good at creating jobs. I hope so. I mean, the man says he's going to do it. I wouldn't like to call him a liar. I'd hope he'd stick to his guns like he said he was going to, so that's all I can hope for.
Well, now, politicians don't lie, do they?
Well, he's not a politician.
Jonathan didn't always vote for Republicans. In 2008, he says he voted for Obama, and he's a union miner, and unions tend to support Democrats.
I believe even the unions now are ready for a change.
It's early, but Jonathan says he's seeing a change for the better in his community. Coal stocks are up, the price of coal has increased some too. And here's one sign. Jonathan says inexperienced miners, including his brother-in-law, are finding work.
Red hats are finally getting, you know, to be able to get hired. And I haven't seen that since I was red hat 5 years ago.
Jonathan just recently got his job back after he was laid off for about 7 months. And while he was called back to work, plenty of his friends and family were not. Getting rid of that worry would make him happier and healthier.
I wouldn't have to sit here and worry about if I'm going to have a job today or tomorrow and see if my five kids are going to eat or not. And that'd make me happy and keep me from stressing out. And, you know, when you get stressed out about worrying about if you have a job or not, you know, something can happen. You know, you can be at work and thinking about it and something bad could happen and I might not come home.
Coming up next, we'll hear about why working class people in Appalachia and across the nation were attracted to Trump. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We're talking about what a Donald Trump presidency means for Appalachia. There's no denying that Appalachia went big for Trump. 69% of West Virginia voters picked Trump, the highest level of support in the country. He did nearly as well in Kentucky, Tennessee, and the Appalachian parts of Ohio and North Carolina. We've been hearing Jonathan Griffith share why he voted for Donald Trump. Griffith is a coal miner from southern West Virginia. Yes, it is the economy, but he says he voted for Trump because of his values and beliefs, too. He gets upset when he hears about what he calls younger kids protesting Trump by missing school and burning the American flag. It made him angry, especially since his wife and father-in-law served in the military.
It's very disrespectful for, you know, the people that fought for it and the people that, you know, hasn't fought for it. You know, I get to live my life on what the people did fight for, and I am grateful for that and for, you know, college kids, high school kids missing school. You know, people that can't even vote are crying and whining about this. It's very sickening.
To help us understand why Jonathan and so many other working class people in our region supported Trump, we turn to researcher Dr. Joan Williams. She spoke with Laurie Lynn and Scott Finn on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, The Front Porch, about the class culture gap.
What key element of the class culture gap that's relevant to the election is that white working class folks tend to admire the very rich, but really resent professionals. They resent professionals because these are the people who are ordering them around every day, often disrespectfully. This is the college kid who comes in and gets the job ahead of you and tells you how to do the job you've been doing for 30 years. This is the doctor who treats you like an idiot or condescends to you, the teacher who condescends to you and communicates that she feels better than you because she has more of an education. So a tremendous amount of resentment of professionals. On the other hand, the rich, that's what the white working class would like to be. They don't want to make all of the cultural changes that would be required for them to become professional families. They just want to be exactly the way they are, living their lives the way they've always lived them, with the values they've always had, but with more money. And so in many ways, Hillary Clinton represented to, I think, many Trump voters, the sort of condescension of professionals, whereas Trump represented their dream of, like, be just like I am, be able to do not mess with that political correctness nonsense, say what you want to say, say it in a direct way, but with the freedom of being a billionaire.
Then what a lot of people want is they want to have their same lives in the same way, but with more money. They saw in their parents, let's say, a certain way of life. The man is the breadwinner. The woman gets to stay home if she wants. And if they can't have exactly that, they're going to be upset. Well, that doesn't seem like – it doesn't seem very adult to me. That seems like almost like a childish reaction.
If I can't have things exactly the way I want, I don't have to change. I don't want anything to be different. I just want more money. That doesn't seem like a very mature way of looking at the world. Am I being too harsh there?
I think you're just being elite there. I remember I was talking to one working class guy, and he said to me, "I associate change with loss," he said. And I went like, whoa, ain't that the truth? That's the attraction of stability, because change typically means loss. And that's what this whole class of people has seen over the past 20, 30, 40 years. Change has meant loss. And so I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who lives in Georgia. She was saying, you know, what these people really are saying is that there's a whole lot of people here in the South who they had the three-bedroom home with the two baths, cinder block, very, very modest home, and they had full-time jobs, and they didn't do anything wrong, and now they're losing all of it. That does not strike me as whining. That strikes me as an exploited group, furious that they were given so little, they were satisfied with that little, and now that little is being taken away. These people aren't whining. These people are in pain because they had, for two short generations, they could live stable middle-class lives, and now they're losing that. We need to listen to this.
Well, I get that, but I want to push this just a little bit farther. I'm assuming that unless the laws of the world change in a substantial way, these trends that require people to have more education in order to have a decent life, I don't see them going the other way.
We have approached it with utter class cluelessness. We have said, if you want a stable life, get a college education. You know, that's what worked for me. I went to Yale, Harvard, and MIT. Hey, it worked great, you know, and my daddy paid the whole time. So what we're offering them is the ladder up that works for professionals, but we're not offering them any realistic ladder up that's going to work for people like them.
That's Dr. Joan Williams. Hear more of her interview on the Front Porch podcast at wvpublic.org. Williams talked about some of the cultural reasons white working class voters supported Trump. So how can Trump supporters justify statements from Trump that many find offensive, like this one about Mexicans?
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Or this one targeted at former Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account is
only Rosie O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't.
She gets out and she starts asking me all sorts of ridiculous questions. And, you know, you could see there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
I asked coal miner Jonathan Griffith and his wife Jessica about this. I was in their living room with them and their kids. And Jessica says Trump could have worded things a little differently, but
I don't think he would ever do anything to actually hurt anybody like that. I think, you know, the media sometimes can twist stuff around, you know, to make it look like he's the bad guy, when all in all, you know, one of his main posts about or sayings about immigration and stuff, that he didn't say you couldn't come over here. He just said you have to do it the right way. And I think that's, you know, they just twisted it around to make him look like the bad guy. So, you know, I hope that was the case with that too. But I mean, they all say stuff that we don't like. I mean, that's just how it is, and you just got to pick the lesser of the two evils, you know.
But for other people from Appalachia, Trump's statements on Muslims, women, and immigrants disqualified him for the presidency. Sharif Youssef is the child of an Egyptian immigrant who grew up in the town of West Liberty, West Virginia. Now he works as a producer on the popular podcast 99% Invisible. After the election, Youssef spoke with Scott Finn and Rick Wilson, hosts of the Front Porch podcast, about the discrimination he faced as both an Arab American in Appalachia and later as an Appalachian American at Yale and San Francisco.
I think I have a very unique perspective on this election. I come from three very distinct places that I have ties to: Egypt, West Virginia, and Yale University. And all three are so distinct culturally as to be almost different countries. I tend to be very liberal, very progressive, and my Facebook feed is filled with other liberals and progressive thanks to Facebook's algorithms. So I saw a lot of heartache and disappointment after the election, and I felt that. I felt pretty terrified, not so much for me because I am white passing, but for my father, who teaches physics to people who don't really want to learn physics, so he already has some animosity built into his job, but also lives in a very rural area in West Liberty, West Virginia. I felt scared for my friends of color and for my queer, genderqueer, trans friends. And because I went to these liberal places like Yale and the Bay Area where I live now, I also see the sort of condescension that often is associated with West Virginia and Appalachia. When I told people I came from West Virginia at Yale, "Oh, you don't seem like a West Virginian," which was condescending because I knew that in their mind they had this really stereotypical vision of a West Virginian with like rotting teeth and morbidly obese and really dumb. And while I don't agree with that, I took it as a compliment that they didn't think I was that. Yeah, I just thought that perhaps sharing my perspectives on being discriminated against in West Virginia, perspectives of going to a liberal elite college and having similar condescension, showing that that stuff still exists outside of places that are more stereotypically discriminatory, I thought that unique perspective would be something that people would get some value and insight from.
Let me ask you about your experiences with people not being very tolerant of your religion when you were growing up in the Northern Panhandle. And what's it like? What actually happened to you?
I experienced everything from like people in middle school like following me around the hallways, calling me a terrorist, to more subtle things like during Ramadan, which I practiced in middle school. People would sort of go out of their way to like ask me, like, "Why are you doing this? Just eat something. Your dad won't know." And I'm like, "Oh, it's not about like whether my dad would know." They're like, "Oh, whatever." So having like your religion sort of cast aside, despite me not trying to like influence others to join it or whatever, was hurtful. I was harassed on the school bus going home. People would call me towelhead. People would call me like camel jockey. Some people would use worse words than that that I'm not sure if I should say on air. This unsettled feeling of never quite feeling at home is probably like the sense I get the most when I think about that stuff happening.
I was wondering how your experience changed at specific critical times, for example, around 9/11. Was it an issue before that in your memory? I know you're not as old as I am in the buildup of the Iraq War. You know, just how did it fluctuate in terms of public events?
Sure. I would say 9/11 was definitely a catalyzing point. That happened when I was in fourth grade, and then middle schools was fifth grade to eighth grade. So I remember like most distinctly in middle school, partly because in middle school it got a bunch of different elementary schools sending all the kids to the same place. So maybe the people in fourth grade who like knew me better and knew that like I didn't have a hateful bone in my body might have been more tolerant. And then in middle school, getting other people in, hearing the name Sharif Youssef, looking at my dark features, like my dark eyebrows, my dark hair, I think that was definitely a catalyst.
So your dad still lives here. You've moved out to the Bay Area to a very successful career as a producer. Does your dad have a different view of living in West Virginia than you do? Because you seem to have a pretty dismal view of the place based on how you were treated while you were growing up here.
Dismal in some senses, but like the community that I did have were really kind and friendly, and people like often went out of their way to say hi to each other, and I really appreciated that. My dad like ran over a small rock in his car with me in it, and like our tire went flat, and someone saw us and like took us to their house, and they had like a garage filled with tools and helped change the tire. That stuff that is like really special to me that you can't find just anywhere, and that's something that I really do love about West Virginia. But I talked to my father and his wife, Linda, on the phone, my stepmother. He's not like a very social person. Like he pretty much works and then stays home and plays with the cats. So he doesn't have to interact with a whole lot of people that he doesn't have to. But I've seen people like look at him with like, I don't know, shady eyes in Kroger. So I know like that stuff exists towards him. But I think first generations or immigrants in particular, have a different view of racism because they're just like more used to it. So I think he does have a view of like, okay, this might be like a tough 4 years. One thing that he said that was pretty profound that I hadn't really thought about. He's like, I grew up in Egypt where Hosni Mubarak had been reigning for many years. And he was just like, I just had to accept that. We didn't really have a say in what happened. We just had to accept corrupt leaders if they were thrust upon us. Despite the election not going the way he would have wanted, he was like, it's kind of cool that in a democratic republic, something won't go your way pretty frequently, but at least you have a say in it. And that was something that I didn't really think about too much because I was too young to think about politics when I did live in Egypt.
Sharif, there's been a lot of commentary about Trump voters, obviously, and Jamel Bowie from Slate has an article that's entitled There's No Such Thing as a Good Trump Voter, and basically says that people voted for a racist who promised racist outcomes and they don't deserve your empathy.
Yeah, I have already skimmed that article, and I also read another article from, I think, a professor at University of Wisconsin-Madison who actually went to rural communities and sat with them for longer than like an hour and kept going back and talking to them and hearing what they had to say about the divide between rural and urban. And I honestly like don't know. I think understanding people regardless of politics is really important. This has been helpful talking to you guys who are still in West Virginia to like understand your perspective on things. Hopefully hearing mine are illuminating in some way too. But at the same time, like Trump espoused so much hatred, like not even remotely censored, like admitting to sexual assault, creating a national registry for people who have a different religion, banning all immigration, deporting millions of people. So like in a way, I do see that as like voting for him as implicit condoning of his behavior. But to be honest, I think the narrative of like it was poor, racist white people who elected Trump to president is false. Hillary Clinton, the only income brackets that she won were people who made 50 grand or less a year. But every other income bracket voted for Trump. So I think like not everyone who voted for Trump was a racist. I think some of the people were, for sure. But I think a lot of people saw that like he was just using rhetoric to gain bigoted support that he needed to win the election. And then it was other people who were like, OK, he probably won't actually be able to do a lot of this stuff, but I'm going to vote for him because it will decrease my taxes. I think that is also a narrative that's not getting enough play in the media.
That's Sharif Youssef, West Virginia native, Arab American and Trump critic. Today, we're hearing folks in our region share how they feel about Donald Trump becoming president. Next, let's hear from a woman who says she was a reluctant supporter of Trump. Republican Patricia Rucker is one of just three women elected to the West Virginia Senate in 2016. She's a former teacher who homeschools her five children. She's also an immigrant from Venezuela.
I do believe that the United States is a great country with opportunities for everyone. I would hope that we would not allow the divisiveness of certain people or groups to break up what really made this nation wonderful, which is it is a nation of immigrants.
So what does she think about President Trump and all of his remarks about Latinos and immigrants on the campaign trail?
I have to admit that after a lot of struggle, I did end up voting for Donald Trump. I just was not 100% sure that Donald Trump was going to stay true to, you know, what he said he would do. And, you know, he's so new to the political arena. And obviously, we've all heard, you know, that he has not been the greatest speaker. He has not said things like I would ever say. And some of his opinions I completely disagree with.
Rucker says she would have loved to have had a female president, just not Hillary Clinton.
Her threats to West Virginia coal, her promise to basically make gun ownership much harder. I mean, those are things that I just could not possibly ever support.
So Patricia Rucker voted for Trump, even though she recognizes his weaknesses. Reverend Ronald English voted against Trump, even though he admits to Trump's strengths.
In a strange kind of way, Trump was like King.
Huh?
In terms of touching the emotion that he felt and knew was there and firing it into a movement.
English can talk about Martin Luther King with some authority. He worked with King for several years. Now he's a Baptist preacher in Charleston, West Virginia. And that guy you heard asking, huh? Well, that's Trey Kay, host and producer of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's podcast, Us and Them. He asked English if he felt anxious over Trump's election.
I've felt that I have personally, and I've noticed other people who have had a lot of anxiety and difficulty with this election. Before the election, I found that my anxiety was higher than it normally was. I was angry with people, lashing out with people, you know, getting into, like, screaming my head off at some points. So my first question would be, have you had to speak or pastor people with regard to any anxiety regarding this election?
No, not in the sense that you just described. Barack Obama's election was suggesting that we had arrived at a place of equality. We had not dealt with the undercurrent of racism that had run through this nation.
I was surprised by the result of the election. It doesn't sound like you were surprised.
Not really. The reason I'm not surprised is because the reality of racism weaving in the very fabric of what it is to be in this country is something I was just expecting would show up in terms of a reaction, and it happened to be in this particular way.
I have to tell you, I loved the service yesterday, and I loved the message, focusing on this idea of prepare ye the way of the Lord.
But Isaiah, as the prophet, is saying right there where you are, in the wilderness, that's where I want you to prepare a way for the Lord.
Amen. Amen.
Make straight in the desert a highway for our God.
Is there a message in there that can speak to those of us who are just having a difficult time acclimating to these difficult times?
What the text really says is that I'm coming into the wilderness. Whatever situation of wilderness we are in, whatever moment of darkness we are in, we've been here before, after the Civil War. And something comes out of the Civil War that brings about a new creation. You don't anticipate how it's going to happen. You really don't know how it's going to happen. And that's my hope in terms of how this may be the evening of a awakening that was not intended by what brought Trump into office. And the biblical perspective on that is that we really don't know what the darkness is hiding. It may very well be that the darkness is hiding a glory that we just can't see. And I've never even thought about it before until now. But in a strange kind of way, Trump was like King.
Huh?
In terms of touching the emotion that he felt and knew was there and firing it into a movement that brought about a critical change in the country. But it's not about intellect. It's about emotion. And he was able to speak to that emotion of folk who felt like they were unheard and abused and misused. And because of that, he becomes their, not only their spokesperson to speak for them, but their hero and now their president. That's how I'm talking about them being, you know, kind of similar in terms of how they responded to a mood that led into a movement.
That was Reverend Ronald English. You can hear more on the Us and Them podcast. Find it at wvpublic.org.
Thank you.
We're talking today about what a Trump presidency means for Appalachia. And one question is, what will happen to coal miners with black lung? A provision in the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, made it easier for miners with the disease to get medical care. And if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, well, it's unclear what happens to black lung victims. Come to find out, black lung is making a comeback. More miners are being diagnosed with the disease, even as the federal government has failed to keep an accurate count, according to an investigation by NPR's Howard Burkus. Here's black lung victim Mackie Branham of Elkhorn Creek, Kentucky. He's just 39 years old.
Me, I've never been scared of death. It don't bother me a bit. It's just not seeing my kids grow up. But if I had it to do over, I would do it again. If that's what it took to provide for my family as long as I have.
We asked West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito what Congress and the Trump administration should do about black lung. Capito spoke with hosts Rick Wilson and Lori Lynn on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's The Front Porch podcast.
So I think the crux of the report that I read at NPR is that there's something maybe new happening here with our younger miners. I just met this week with probably 10 people who are afflicted with black lung who are concerned about the continuation of the benefit that they have now. And I'm certainly committed to that, have been, and will continue to be. And also for their widows. Some of them meet early deaths because of this, and they're concerned about their families as they move on. And that's a concern I hold as well. I think that, you know, safer conditions are always something that we need to move forward on. MSHA just went forward with a lower coal dust standard. That's a human tragedy that we just heard, and it's sad. The sad part, I think, for all of us and for me as well, is when he states that he would do it all over again, even though he's struggling for breath. And I don't know that that's a situation that we want to keep enforcing, that that's what you're going to do everything no matter what. We shouldn't have that.
So on a related question, first, thanks for supporting the Miners Protection Act. I'm just curious what you think the prospects for that are in the coming year.
You know, I think they're good. I'm really disappointed, Rick, in the way the whole thing shook out in the end. We couldn't push it any further than 4 months, which is a huge disappointment. And as I talked to those miners, they were disappointed. They did seem to understand that we can live to fight another day. So what we need to do is attack this earlier. McConnell did say on the floor of the Senate that he doesn't see any reason why this shouldn't be able to be taken care of. I couldn't believe they want to hear us fight about it again, because we're going to have so much going on in the spring. So I'm optimistic, but cautiously so, because we've been optimistic before.
Senator, West Virginians voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, almost 69% more than any other state. So I think it's fair to say that expectations are high. What can West Virginians hope for from a Trump administration?
I think West Virginians felt taken advantage of, overlooked, underappreciated, and really not as being a part of, over the last 8 years, haven't felt like they've been a part of this future for their children and their grandchildren. And it was reflected in everybody's vote. And I think President-elect Trump tapped into this, not just in West Virginia, but in a lot of different places. If we move, I think, in a reasonable fashion, he moves in a reasonable fashion to sort of unleash some of the regulations that are holding back some of our energy jobs. But I think we all realize it's not going to come back to where it is. And I don't think people who are in the business for many years believe that to be true, or miners. I think that President-elect Trump shouldn't try. This is hard for him to not overpromise, because I think that just will breed discontent quickly. But I do think that the other message was, we're ready to shake it up, and we're going to risk. Maybe we don't like everything about this guy and maybe the way he presents certain things, but we're willing to risk this because the status quo hasn't worked for us, and Washington isn't working.
That's West Virginia Senator Shelley Moore Capito speaking on West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Front Porch podcast. Since this episode first aired, Republicans have released a proposed replacement for the Affordable Care Act. The ACA included a provision that made it easier for miners to get black lung benefits. So far, that provision was preserved in the new Republican proposed health care plan. The replacement plan has faced criticism from both Democrats and Republicans and is being debated in Congress. Shelley Moore Capito is one of four Republicans who have spoken out against the new plan. Appalachia supported Trump in part because the region is hurting. Lifespans in many parts of Appalachia are declining. West Virginia has the highest drug overdose rate in the country. The federal agency with a mandate to help fix those problems is the Appalachian Regional Commission, or the ARC. So I asked the ARC co-chairman Earl Gohl what should happen next.
It is so critical for communities to look and understand that they have assets beyond coal, to look and understand that the folks who live in their communities have more skills, have more ability than just to do one job.
The ARC helps distribute money for different types of projects, such as infrastructure, throughout the region. Trump has promised to spend more on infrastructure, and Gohl says Appalachia needs more roads, more water and sewer systems, and especially more access to high-speed internet. Despite all of our region's challenges, Gohl encourages us not to lose sight of our opportunities.
People can talk, or folks can focus on the woes of Appalachia. My approach has really been to focus on the opportunities in Appalachia. And I would argue something very different. My message to folks who live in Appalachian communities is that Appalachia really is the has the potential of being the next great investment opportunity in America.
That was Appalachian Regional Commission Federal Co-Chair Earl Gohl talking about the needs and potential of Appalachia. Since this story first aired in January, President Trump released his proposed budget plan on March 16th. It calls for eliminating funding for several federal programs, including the Appalachian Regional Commission. The president's budget proposal also calls for eliminating funding for the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And in the interest of full transparency, West Virginia Public Broadcasting receives some funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. After the election, I felt torn. A lot of people I know, family, friends, neighbors, felt ecstatic over Trump's election. Meanwhile, I know lots of people who believe that anyone who voted for Trump is deplorable. So I wanted to tell the story of Jonathan and Jessica Griffith because people in the coalfields deserve better. They're intelligent, well-informed, and accepting of people who are different from them. During my visit, Jessica bounces their baby boy on her knee, and Jonathan rummages through the cabinets looking for things to pack in his lunch bucket. He's worked for about 5 years underground as a roof bolter. It's considered one of the most dangerous jobs. It's also one of the best paying.
The life of a coal miner is pretty rough. There's nights you come home and you're tired. You really just don't want to do nothing, sleep and, you know, go back to work. But then there's nights, you know, you have to make yourself, you know, spend time with the family.
It's like you're a single parent a lot of times because he's just not there. You know, they work 6 days a week, sometimes 12 hours a day, and then by the time they sleep, it's time to start over. Like our older three kids, he don't even see them till the weekends because they're gone when he's asleep, and by the time they get home from school, he's gone back to work, and it makes it tough, especially all the running you have to do by yourself with five of them.
Jonathan's dad didn't want him to become a coal miner. Jonathan doesn't want any of his five boys to become miners either. Jonathan and Jessica hope they can use this coal mining money to get them a college education.
I kind of contradict myself. I'm trying to talk myself into hoping my kids don't get into it because it is a dangerous job. You try to make it as safe as you can, but it is. It's very dangerous, and I don't want my kids doing it. I couldn't imagine my kids doing it. You know, like I said, I do it because, yeah, I do like it, but the money's good.
Jonathan was laid off for about 7 months last year. He says if he gets laid off again, he'll go back to school and try to get away from the mining industry.
It's not that I don't like it. I love being a coal miner. I love my job. It's just, it gets tiring. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, sometimes you come home, you'll sleep all day long, and you hate doing it, and then there's sometimes you sleep and you're fine. And I'd really like to spend more time with my kids and family, and if I could find a better paying job to do that, yeah, I'd be gone.
Do you know what you'd want to study?
Culinary arts. I'd go into cooking. That was my thing when I was laid off. I enjoyed doing.
So why not now? It's a question I've read on social media and in stories. Well, the Griffiths did think about moving. They weighed their options and looked at moving to Alabama when he was laid off.
I mean, it's hard to pick up and leave, you know, to take your kids away from their friends and from, you know, from their family that they're close to. And then the cost of living in other places is a lot higher also. So you think of trying to buy a new house and then, you know, would we still be able to survive on income? Would I have to get a job too? And then you have to pay for daycare. So, you know, there's a lot of factors. It ain't just like, oh, well, we can just pick up and move. There's a lot to it.
So the Griffiths, like so many other coal country families, fight to keep what they have.
A lot of people talked about coal mines like it's eventually going to be gone and, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, one day it probably will be, but, you know, you got to work what you got while you got it. And people are like, well, why do you want to vote for somebody that, you know, says that they can save it and you don't know? But, you know, when you're looking at somebody, say you're starving to death and you have two people and one's like, I'm not going to give you food no matter what you're going to do. And the other person's like, yeah, you know, you come with me, I'm going to provide food for you. I mean, obviously you're going to choose the one that says, you know, they're going to give you the food, even though they might not. Like, you're going to take that chance because you want it and stuff, rather than just being like, okay, I'm not doing it at all. And that's how I looked at it.
That's Jessica Griffith, stay-at-home mom, veteran, and coal miner's wife. Her husband, Jonathan, has been an underground miner in southern West Virginia for about 5 years. Since we last spoke with Jessica, the mine where Jonathan works slowed production for a few weeks because they hit some rock, but has since picked back up. Jessica says she thinks President Trump is definitely working on keeping promises he's making. On this show, we've spoken to supporters and opponents of Trump in Appalachia to find out what it means for our future and what we should be watching. They have a story just the same as anyone else. These folks have done their own research and looked for answers that made sense for their lives. This election was such a surprise to some people, but maybe it wouldn't have been if we just listened to a different viewpoint. Get to know somebody who's a different religion or race or registered as a different political party or someone in a different tax bracket. Or maybe even the man you see at the gas station, covered in coal dust. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Us and Them podcast and the Front Porch podcast. Music in today's show was provided by Jake Sheps, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Scott Finn edited our show this week with help from Suzanne Higgins. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.